and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 154. On this week's show, we are going to review 1980's The Watcher in the Woods and discuss the latest in Disney news, including the Daredevil. To my left, as always, is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Joining us via Skype of the Main Street Gazette is Ryan Wilson. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
And also joining in the general vicinity of Mr. Ryan Wilson is Courtney Van Ren. Say hello, Courtney.
Hello, Courtney.
Hello, Pete. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs, for visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, or traveling anywhere around the globe, visit the experts over at MEI-travel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. We are LastGenPodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at DizMagicHourPod. You can find us on Facebook if you search for Disney Magic Hour. If you're not already in that group, you can add yourself. And if you are in that group, add your friends. You can find the show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. And Melissa, where can everyone find the pictures and the Patreon?
On Instagram, we're at Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And if you head over to patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour, you can find ways to help support the show there.
And Ryan, where can everyone find everything that you do for the Main Street Gazette?
The main site is mainstgazette.com. If you're looking for us on Instagram or Twitter, it's mainstgazette. And if you search for Main Street Gazette on Facebook, you can find the page there too.
There you are. Here we are. How's everyone doing?
Good.
Great.
Huzzah.
Excellent. Let's get into the news. We have just one bit of news. It was the only thing I really kind of found, I remembered from this week that mattered. Okay. And that is, hey, guess what?
What?
Disney be canceling everything.
Yeah, they do.
So following the recent axing of Luke Cage and Iron Fist, which we found someone who really loves Iron Fist yesterday.
Yeah, he was a diamond in the rough.
Yeah. So big Iron Fist. He was a diamond in the rough? Does that work?
It's unique, yeah.
All right, yeah. Okay. So after three seasons, though, guess what? Daredevil is also canceled. So, I mean, this all makes kind of obvious sense when you see they already kicked off Luke Cage and Iron Fist, but now everyone is wondering, what is the future of these characters? Is there a future for these characters? Where does that lay? The rights with the Netflix thing is something that I don't really think anyone knows that much about. So that's going to be a big part of it. I don't think it fits anywhere on Disney Plus because these are R-rated shows.
Sorry.
Yes.
I was going to say, like, we don't technically know what the other shows that they're going to be putting on there. Like, we know that The Mandalorian's going to be put on there, but I don't think it'll be R, but I
no,
mean...
No, I don't think it's going to be that at all.
Do you think it's going to be PG-13?
No, I don't.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
He's a bounty hunter, isn't he?
Yeah, I think you can shoot someone and it's fine nowadays. I mean, they shoot people all the time on Clone Wars, and that wasn't PG-13.
But that was animated.
I don't think it really matters.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that Disney Plus is... what you think of what Disney Plus would be. What do you think, Ryan? No? Yes?
I you know what? It's going to depend on my vantage point on it is how many Touchstone pictures do they start throwing into the mix? Because there's some risque and some, you know, not exactly what you would think is Disney family friendly in the Touchstone branch. So if there's a lot of that ends up on there, there's room for a little bit, you know, maybe not an R, but a PG-13.
But aren't they also, isn't Hulu part of this whole mix?
No, so...
Because if Hulu, that's something. If Hulu becomes part of the Disney measure, or if they at least just have, like, a rooting interest in it, then that's where they dump all the Touchstone stuff, you know.
So where it comes in is because Fox has a high percentage of ownership over Hulu that Disney's internalizing. So the argument really on the streaming side is not so much that Hulu's going to be involved with Disney Plus, it's... How much of a, you know, of a monopoly is now Disney trying to pull on the streaming side of things with their own piece plus ownership of Hulu or a vested interest in Hulu?
Yeah, so then maybe that's
who
I
knows.
Know. I feel like that's
we don't know enough yet. I don't think. Yeah.
But you know, what if it was done, Melissa? Do you feel satisfied with any of those stories?
No, I want more. I mean, I don't think Luke Cage ended in a position where his story was complete. Iron Fist finally got interesting in the last 5 minutes. Daredevil definitely isn't done. Obviously, I want to see more of Jessica Jones and the Punisher. Like, there's so much more to be told. And obviously, like, you can do other stuff with Luke Cage and Iron Fist. Like, I don't remember if it's branded as, like, Netflix's blah, 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 you know? Like, that might be why it's being canceled. But, like, you can bring those characters back under a different show name. Like, that's fine.
It's not like that. I don't believe so.
What?
It's Marvel's, you know?
Oh, okay. Yeah, like, I didn't know how it was branded.
I don't know what the actual rights are, because that's what really matters.
Well, the rights would be under Marvel leasing it to Netflix.
Well, no, that's the thing. I don't know that. That's the thing. If I knew that, then that means that then they have the characters back fully and they can do whatever they want with them. But there might be a thing where, like, you know, oh, if this is canceled, you can't use them for X amount of time or whatever. Like, there might be something crazy because that's what, you know. I mean, unless Netflix just signed a contract that was like, yeah, until you start your own thing, we'll help you out, which is a possibility.
I mean, they could have done it for X years. I mean, I know the licensing stuff that I've worked on, usually as soon as whatever is done, the term is done, the rights revert back to whoever had them.
Yeah, but this was, but that's the thing. Like, I don't know if that's what this is, because this was canceled.
Yeah, but there's always a termination clause, so they could have had, like, a 30-day termination clause or a 60, 90-day thing.
We'll find out, I guess. Yeah. So.
And they were really weird with how it was phrased, like in the cancellation notes. Like, Marvel's notice about it was had that line at the end that, you know, while the series on Netflix has ended, the Daredevil character will live on in future projects for Marvel.
Yeah.
So they didn't say what that was, but I know it caught all the cast, but the entire cast was caught by surprise at the notice. So who knows what that means and what the future looks like? But
well, I mean, for my money, Daredevil is the character that, if you put into a movie, like their own Marvel Knights series of films, Daredevil is the movie that I'm going to see at the theater.
Yeah.
Luke Cage right behind it.
Yeah.
But that's, if you want to get into something like that, that's, I think that's a smart move. Jesus, Marvel did it years ago. You know, Joe Quesada heading up the Marvel Knights thing. I believe Daredevil was the lead into that series. And that sort of ushered in a more adult-ish type of era for Marvel at the time. And if they want to mirror that in the film universe way, yeah, I would definitely pay good money to go see a budgeted Daredevil flick with Mr. Fisk.
Mm.
1,000% and a proper-ass bullseye.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Courtney, any thought on the whole Marveling?
I mean, I don't have a ton of thoughts on it. I still haven't finished all the shows, so I'm not as invested as a lot of other people are in it. But I definitely think for the streaming service, I mean, Netflix has the whole thing where you can do the adult stuff and the kids stuff. So if there was a way, if there was going to be a filter on something, Disney would figure out how to do that. So you could definitely split it into, you know, the adult material and the children's material. So I think there's room for those shows if they want to do it that way.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, you could always do that. I don't know. I hope. That would be my thing. Is like, I don't want crap everywhere. You know, like, I want to be able to go to one place and find everything. We just know Disney's weird with stuff like that. Or just very cautious, I guess is a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
We saw a movie this week. Oh, you know what? I guess we can just sort of comment on this. So this is an odd thing with the embargo status of Mary Poppins.
Yes.
We saw the film last weekend, and while the social media embargo is now finished, the actual written and or said review is not. I believe is on December 12th.
Yeah, it's really a weird,
strange thing, because you can pretty much write in a review on social media. I don't really get what the point is. But so if you want our thoughts on the movie, go to our Instagram account.
Yeah.
Which is Disney Magic Hour Podcast, right?
Yeah. I regrammed your thoughts. I know I just put up my own at like the day before. I'm doing a written article, and maybe like we'll do a read or something on that for the Patreon members, but that won't be till December 12th, so we got 10 days to.
Yeah, we'll be recording an actual review for it.
Yeah.
I
mean, just get your tickets.
Tell you what my review is, even though my review is written in Word somewhere else, but I can't write a full review. Yeah, it's weird. So, you know, go check that out. But all right, so let's, anyone else? Was there anything else I missed this week that comes to mind?
The Mandalorian got another one in the cast.
Mandalorian! The Mandalorian found the one man who could fit into that film without needing any makeup at all. Nick Nolte is now also added into the Mandalorian. This show is just getting better and better by the second. My anticipation for this show needs to stop because I'm going to up it too much. I don't know. This is great. I just love the idea that they're going with this obvious sort of heavy Western thing. Ryan, were you excited by old Mr. Beardy?
I was, but more into the line of the fact that it does. It looks like it's an old Western. Like, we're just going to do, which Star Wars has its old Western vein. Like, it always has. And so to be embracing that is just wonderful.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about that. Speaking of Westerns, if you are, an adult, you should absolutely watch The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is on Netflix, the new Coen Brothers film. And then tell me about it so we can talk about it. Because, oh my God, it was so good. Is everyone ready to talk about The Watcher in the Woods?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Is everyone strapped in for this one? The Watcher in the Woods released. Okay.
Technically.
So let's first, I got to first start on that.
And we're already having our first side.
Yeah, so initially released for a small theatrical run in April of 1980, it did not have its actual premiere-ish thing for the rest of the world until October 9th, 1981. The reason behind that is that when it was initially shown in a test run in New York City, it had such a bad reaction that the studio wound up doing over $1 million in a rehaul for the ending in order to try to fix up what the main complaint was. So at the end of the day, it came in at a runtime of 84 minutes. It has a budget that I literally could not nail down. And it did gross $5 million, which is not a lot, even for that day and age. It was produced by Ron Miller, Tom Leach, and Hugh Atwell. And it was directed by John Hugh, who also helmed a version of Treasure Island starring Orson Welles as Long John Silver, which immediately goes to like my list of things I must see. He also shot the second entry into the Witch Mountain series, Return to Witch Mountain, which also starred Bette Davis, who we're going to see in this movie, and also had Christopher Lee in it, which not a great film, but it might be worth just to sit through it just to see them two on screen. But the role that got him this was his work on The Legend of Hell House, which Ron Miller saw and kind of inspired him to choose Hugh as a director for this project. He also did a lot of episodes of television with the hit TV show at the time, The Avengers, not that one. This one has English Folk, Bowler Hats, and Diana Rigg. And he was actually, I think it was like 6 episodes that he did for the main. He like shot 6 of his own, but his second unit directed 17 others. So as I said a little bit earlier, though, there was some reshoots. The reshoots were not done by John Hugh, though, because he wasn't available. That was done uncredited at the time due to some Directors Guild stuff by Vincent McEvity, who actually shot episodes of the original Star Trek series, including Balance of Terror. Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo, which is just the same thing as a Star Trek episode. 40 episodes of Simon and Simon, 28 episodes of Murder, She Wrote, 7 episodes of Columbo. I guess he had a thing that he was really good at. And he actually did the reshoots on that. Behind the camera was Alan Hume for the cinematography, also lit Return of the Jedi, along with a number of Bond films, For Your Eyes Only, which we're going to see one of our other actresses, features prominently in that one. He also shot Octopussy, A View to a Kill, and 1984's Supergirl with Helen Slater, and then one of the best comedies of all time, Fish Called Wanda. So there's a good pedigree of like 70s and 80s behind that, but Ryan, there's a story to this movie. Like they have a story, right? It came from somewhere. Where's the history of that stuff?
So it actually came from the 1976 novel by Florence Ingall Randall called A Watcher in the Woods. There are a couple of releases of the book where they call it The Watch, where they put the instead of the A so that people understand it's the same thing. But it came from A Watcher in the Woods. So it was pitched to Miller. They get Brian Clemens to adapt it into a screenplay. They look at that version and say, yeah, that's a little too dark for us. And going back to our Daredevil conversation earlier. So they get Rosemary Ann Sisson to come in and do another draft of it. She's known a lot for a lot of BBC animation that she wrote. She did some Upstairs, Downstairs, Candle Shoe. But and then she also did several episodes of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. So that's where we get her. So she does it. So she gives it a pass on it. It's in later into July 79. So we're now well within 6 months of this movie being released. And they're rewriting it again with Jerry Day. And this is someone who did a lot of co-writing on different Western pieces. Really loved kind of things like Little House on the Prairie, the Templeton House, the Virginian. So we have a Western vibe now coming into play.
That's a good old Hollywood name.
It is a really good old Hollywood name.
Send it over to Jerry Day.
Yeah. And so once she's finished with it, we're into filming. And then you have Ron Miller who comes in and decides to, you know, try to tone down scenes and help them rework scenes while they're shooting. We talked about how this was released in the 80 and then 81 because they redid the entire ending. And that comes with at the hands basically of Harrison Ellenshaw, which we all know Peter Ellenshaw. We've talked about him repeatedly. He's brought in from this movie. And you know, when asked about what this, you know, what this was like when it was released and that, because he only came on for that ending, he goes, well, the film was released, then it was pulled. The story department and various people at the studio all came up with endings. I have all those endings in a package. They were all awful, and that was part of the problem. They appear that they came up with three endings that were submitted to the story department, who in turn came out with their own versions. So when I was asked to come aboard, I was handed a pile of these endings, roughly 152.
Oh, my goodness.
Jesus.
That was followed up with for the second version, just for the second version is the second. It's the follow-up question. He goes, yes, I had absolutely nothing to do with the first version. I wasn't even at the studio. I was working on The Empire Strikes Back. So the first thing I did was look at the film. And then I went through all these endings, which were all wretched.
We'll break down those endings shortly after this.
Right. Yeah, So that gets us our story and much of the story, or a little bit of the story behind the scenes.
Oh, wow. All right. So we have a story finally. God help us all. And I'm going to say, you know, I just want to say off the bat, I think this movie is really close to being really great. And it does sort of, this ending that no one could figure out stands out really, really harshly. But all right, we'll get to that. So Melissa, we have a story. We have a crew. We need actors. We need players. Who do we have?
We have a lot. So I kind of pared it down as much as I could.
Good.
We'll start with probably the best or the one most well-known name, Miss Betty Davis. Betty Davis as. She plays our Mrs. Aylward. Okay.
Aylward.
I had to like look up how to spell it while I was taking notes. It was odd. I mean, she's known for just a bunch. I went basically through her Academy Award noms and wrote those down. Her wins, I should, or well, whatever. So she got that Bad Sister. Then she won an Academy Award for Dangerous and Jezebel. She was nominated for Dark Victory, The Letter, The Little Foxes, Now Voyager, Mr. Skeffington? I've never heard of that one. All About Eve, The Star, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. More importantly for me, she was the first female president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and she was the first person to accrue 10 Academy Award nominations for acting.
So we should do a whole episode on Whatever Happened to Baby Jane if you've never seen that. Have you never seen that?
I have never seen that. I've never seen any of these movies, actually.
So when I say wire hangers, nothing?
Oh, well, I know that line.
Okay, all right.
Also because Futurama did a really good, funny spoof.
You know what?
On that.
I'm just happy it got to you. That's all that matters. I'm not worried at all about the delivery service. I'm fine with that. Just happy it got there. There was something I noticed really... I'm sorry. Keep going. I apologize.
Well, I'm going to move on.
Moving on.
To our girl, Jan. She's played...
Jan! That one?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll make sure.
Yeah, I know. My tone was not as high-pitched. Miss Lynn Holly Johnson. I did find it interesting. Diane Lane was the first choice for this role.
Yeah, I know. She is one of my all-time crushes, too.
Yeah.
When I read that, I was like... Man, Diane Lane may have been a... I don't know. You can never tell.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Lynn Holly Johnson isn't really... Like, she's an actress, but I don't... She was really more into ice skating, figure skating. She actually won a silver medal in 1974's U.S. figure skating competition at the novice level. So
I think it was the movie Ice Castles that helped because there was a movie about a blind ice skater and... Basically, I don't know if this is accurate, but I want to say it was like that generation's Topic.
I don't know that movie.
Whatever that's. Cutting Edge, right?
The Cutting Edge.
Cutting Edge. So, anyways. But she was in some other notables.
Yeah, but then she went on to, like we said, For Your Eyes Only. She was the Bond girl in that. And she was in Where the Boys Are, 84. So, yeah. She did a couple of things. And you already said Ice Castles. Then we get on to Ellie. Played by Kyle Richards.
I think it's Kylie.
Sorry. Who had an uncredited role in Escape to Witch Mountain. We remember that movie because it had Kim Richards in it. This is her younger sister. So it was one of the flashbacks that Kim Richards had. And
I don't remember that.
Yeah. I don't remember much of that movie.
Okay, because I know her as, well, from the other things that I'm sure you're going to say.
The half-sister to Nikki and Paris Hilton? Mother?
No, that's the dark future that her that she sees. You know what? Okay, so here's a funny thing. When I was looking through IMDb and I was looking through this cast, I was like, man, that's a really updated photo of Kylie Richards. Like, I'm kind of surprised because I've never heard of her in something else. Ever since then, and she looks real good. Then I found out that is because she's on one of the
Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yeah,
yeah.
I was like, oh,
yeah. Okay. She actually has. She looks kind of like Demi Moore.
She looks a lot like Demi Moore. Yeah, a ton. But she's Lindsay from Halloween.
Yeah, she's Halloween.
Which also, I hear Lindsay. So everyone in the late '70s, early '80s, just yelled note voices. Kind of like an annoying way, but yeah, that's pretty much like that's a calling card right there. But that's Lindsay.
Yes, that's Lindsay. She was also on Little House on the Prairie, and she was in an episode of The Wonderful World of Disney. True. She was on The Million Dollar Dixie Deliverance.
That's a good title. Yeah. I don't know what the hell any of that means, but that's a good title.
And she had a run on ER as Nurse Dory. So for anybody who watched that.
I never did. Me neither. I don't know why.
And I was too young for
that. That got real big, you know, at the time when I feel like I would have appreciated it.
Yeah.
I should watch that one of these years.
I know Clooney got really big with that. But yeah, I never...
The Cloons.
...was watching it. Moving on, we'll go to Helen, the mother, played by Carol Baker. She was in quite a few Westerns, actually. Speaking of Westerns, she was in How the West Was Won, Cheyenne Autumn, The Carpetbaggers. She's also in Baby Doll, Giant, Something Wild, Harlow, Native Son. She was in Kindergarten Cop.
She was the evil mom in Kindergarten Cop?
Yes.
Or the grandmother, I guess. That would have been like the evil grandmother, Eleanor Crisp. I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. She was also in Andy Warhol's Bad and in Ironweed with Nicholson and Meryl Streep, who we also just saw.
Also, just really quick, you know what I love? Yeah. She was Michael Douglas's housekeeper in The Game.
Oh, I had The Game written down.
Yeah, Ilsa. Very small role, like not. But that's just awesome. The Game is so good.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen The Game?
I think you showed it to me, yeah.
Yeah? We should watch that again.
Did we discuss that Midnight Madness was the, like, inspiration for that movie?
I don't think so.
This is a total, like, sidebar.
Wait. What?
That Swear. Makes sense. No, that
Swear.
Makes sense.
Swear. Sidebar. Totally. This is from last episode, everyone, if you're just tuning in. Sidebar. Midnight Madness was the inspiration for The Game.
Who? Where? Who said that?
That was in the trivia that we all look at on IMDb. It was on there.
I have to dig into this.
You should, absolutely.
Because is that just like someone on IMDb was like, yo, these movies are alike? Or does that have real thing? Because if it's a real thing, then it needs to be examined deeply.
Write a dissertation.
Okay, who else do we have in this film here?
We have Paul the Father, played by David McCullum, and he is most well known by me for Ducky from NCIS.
Well, that's that is his face.
Yes,
he's 1,000%. Ducky. Yeah.
But he's also probably more well known by most everybody else. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. He was in that for a very long time. He also was a narrator for a Titanic documentary, which sounds really cool. He did also a lot of Alfred voices for Batman animated movies. There were quite a few on his creds, which totally fits him. We have Mike, who I feel like was a very thrown in character in this movie, played by Benedict Taylor, but this was really interesting. He was also in a 2017 The Watcher in the Woods.
The remake with Angelica Houston.
Produced by Angelica
Houston. Directed by Melissa Joan Hart.
Yes, and Melissa Joan Hart. And he played John Keller, which I think is...
Oh, so
he played one of the older guys. Older men.
One of the older guys.
Yeah. An old guy.
He was in Notes on a Scandal with Cate Blanchett.
Yeah, and he was Dench. Like
Eddie? Who was Eddie?
I don't know. He was like probably a side character. I looked into that. It wasn't anything like
Maybe he was one of the other teachers.
He was also a fighter pilot in The Phantom Menace. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like in World War II. And no. I was like, he's not that old.
No. Yeah, his roles got really interesting. So moving on from him, we have Mary. Played by Frances Cuca. She was in a 1971 Sense and Sensibility and 1970 Scrooge, and then a few other TV shows.
Oh, she's in the musical Scrooge.
Yeah.
That's the best Scrooge.
And then just kind of rounding out, we have Tom Colley, played by Richard Pascoe. He was in a lot of British TV series and TV movies. None that really stood out to me, I guess, so I didn't really write them down. John Keller in this one, played by Ian Bannon. Sorry, that was my fault. He was in The Flight of the Phoenix, Braveheart. He was the leper, Waking Ned Divine, and Night Crossing.
Wait, when they say the leper, was he the king? You know, what's his name? Robert the Bruce's father?
I don't know. It says the leper. I've never seen Braveheart, so
because that's
don't
the
know.
Only leper I can think of in that whole movie is Robert the Bruce's father. I gotta look into this.
I don't know.
Does sort of look like him. Oh my god, I think it is.
I've never seen the movie, so I don't know.
You've never seen Braveheart?
No.
Oh, you should see Braveheart. Mel Gibson kills a lot of people, and he's totally not a racist in it.
I don't know if I believe you.
Well, it's true.
All right.
It's 95. We were more innocent then. Waking Ned Divine is also amazing.
Yeah.
And he's in Waking Ned Divine. If you've never seen that, you should see that.
I'm going to finish my last one. Karen. Played by Catherine Levy. She was in British TV series David Copperfield. She was in I, Claudius, Much Ado About Nothing, and Robin of Sherwood. So a lot of...
I mean, Narek?
What?
Did you mean Narek?
No, I did not.
I thought her name was Narek.
No.
Neil Bog. That's Goblin said backwards.
I'm done.
Did you like looking up this cast?
It was interesting. I'll say that much.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, we're gonna leave it there.
Okay.
By the way, Courtney and I have been research on our end over here just to confirm things. Going back to Wire Hangers, that's Mommy Dearest.
Oh yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
That's right. That's Mommy Dearest. Whatever happened to Baby Jane was I'm writing a letter to Daddy.
Yes.
That's that one. Thank you. Yes. Okay.
Right. We just wanted to confirm ourselves. We're like, wait a second, did we miss something somewhere?
Yeah, no, good call. Thank you.
Maybe that was the original source material, and I didn't know.
My God, they're all connected. Like
never happened before.
I've never seen either, so.
I think you would be very upset with both of them. They're both not like fun to watch, but they're really good to watch. They're really great movies. They're just upsetting in so many ways.
Yeah. Well, I watched this movie, so.
Okay. All right. So, actually, a little fun little thing. This is actually primarily shot at Pinewood Studios in Buckinghamshire. And they also used previous sets that were used in Robert Wise's The Haunting.
The original 61. This all makes sense.
So that's really fun. Do you want to talk about the endings? Or we'll talk about the two endings that didn't make the final cut.
Should we talk about it at the end?
No, because it's even more confusing if we wait now. And that makes much more sense considering how everything else works. Let's talk about how we got to the version that like we got to see.
Okay.
So in the original cut, again, we're assuming you've already seen this. The Watcher appears at the end of the movie as a lobster-ish kind of bug-like creature that takes Jan during the ceremony and just disappears. The two of them then fly through the sky over this like alien landscape where we see a crashed alien ship, and as the effects, one of the people who worked the effects, Sam Nicholson, explains it, and if anyone ever uses these first three words when they're explaining something, you know that in their mind they're like, this is just a bunch of shit. He says, for some reason, which is so good. Like, that's his quote. It's like, for some reason, the girl who disappeared and balanced this alien's craft when she went through this portal, which in turn caused this alien to crash.
That makes no sense to me as you're saying it.
So, okay, it doesn't to me either. I've read this so many times and I've tried to figure out what this ending was. So this was my idea. So the alien is traveling through like its own dimensional thing, and these kids do this seance, which has never really explained as to like what the point of the seance was, I think, which would have been very helpful.
Also, I've never heard Ring Around the Rosie like this, but okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. So during this, and because it was the eclipse, they like breach into a different dimension.
Sure.
And so when the girl disappears, when Jan disappears, she pops up in this guy's alien ship and they crash?
I don't know.
Does anyone have a better explanation of this?
I don't, but I could probably give you some clarity because I went back and figured out the ending in the original book, or let me rephrase that, some more about the Watcher in the original book.
Okay.
And that gives you, and it's a little bit easier there. It seems like they took it and then they just kept blowing it up bigger and bigger and bigger and it became a whole other thing. But so in the book, the Watcher is a female alien humanoid child.
Yes.
So she's described as having a pointing chin, upturned nose, and wears a long flowing robe. 50 years before, her parents had taken her to a ceremonial coming-of-age ritual on their home planet in which she was to view Earth. But Karen, who's taking a walk during in the woods, was too near the portal when it opened, and the two changed places. The alien has telepathy. She's able to communicate with children only.
Telepathy.
Because she is her own child. And then, and the reason nobody ages is because on her planet, 50 years is equal to one day. So
wow.
She attempts to communicate to open the door between the worlds. The Watcher has opted to stay. She had opted to stay until the next opening of the portal so that they could use it to get Karen home and reunite her with her mother. So that's the ending in the original book. And then it seems like they just went, you know, balls to the wall crazy with it.
To give you an idea of how people reacted to this original ending that was in the New York run, a quote from the New York Times critic Vincent Canby. I challenge even the most indulgent fan to give a coherent translation of what passes for an explanation at the end. That is such a New York Times like review, number one. That is the most New York Times you can get. And then, Ryan, you spoke about Harrison Ellenshaw earlier, and this was another quote from him. They tried to blend science fiction with a ghost story, and it didn't work. They tried to get a scary alien, but he came out looking like a large lobster with seaweed hanging off him. It was as though the audience had wandered into another picture. You can't break the rules that late in the movie without having the audience feel someone got the last reel mixed up. So after that happens, they're like, okay, we need to redo this. But the only problem on that was that Betty Davis wasn't available at the time, and it was going to cost them a lot of money, but they did it, and they got lucky because the sets that they built for it over at the studios, They weren't destroyed. They were just put into storage, which is kind of random. And if they would have just taken them apart, I think they would have had to just release the film as it was. So when we watch the movie, Bette Davis is in the church.
Yeah.
It's because that's not how the original one ended. The original one ended that they walk the girl home. The girl as in, you know, the one, Karen, who's trapped, Narek. So that was the thing that eventually came out. It was just so crazy. Then there was a middle ending where they leave the alien lobster looking thing in the film, but they took out the section of Karen and the Watcher flying through the space alien thing. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of reappear back in the church after Karen's mom, Jan's mom starts yelling at everybody. So it gave you even less of an explanation, and then the finish came. So it's so weird, but there's music playing during all of this. There are sounds coming from the television. Courtney, who and what aliens were responsible for the music?
The alien in question is Stanley Myers. Stanley Myers was a British composer who passed away in 1993, but he has a great amount of composition credits on IMDb, a lot of which I don't know. And I'm guessing that owes to the fact that he did a lot of like BBC, like British stuff that I wouldn't necessarily know. Mm. But the things that I do know include episodes of the original Doctor Who TV series.
Yay!
Moonlighting, the movie Moonlighting. The Witches, which was a childhood favorite of mine, also starring Angelica Houston. He was nominated for a Saturn Award for that and also won an Ivor Novella Award for this as well, which is an award I'd never heard of before, but apparently it's an award for songwriting and composition. He also won another award of that same award, the Ivor Novella Award, for his guitar piece Cavatina, which was written for the film The Walking Stick, but would later be used as the theme for The Deer Hunter.
There we go.
As soon as I read that, I was like, here comes the peep. That's a weird
rhyme. Yeah, wow. I didn't know that was the line of which that got there.
Yeah. There you have it. I'd never heard that piece until last night, so now I know it.
Oh, that's not the movie. Have you ever watched
Deer Hunter?
I've not.
It is just as upsetting as the other movies that we've recommended other people to watch today.
I believe it, and that makes sense, because this composer was also known for writing the music for the cult horror films of Pete Walker. So House of Whipcord, Frightmare, House of Mortal Sin, and Schizo. So it makes sense that we have, like, some legitimately super creepy music in this movie. It opens with super creepy music.
Yes, it does.
Because, this guy had a good basis in writing for horror films. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of information about him, so that's about all I have.
What was that movie? I thought it was The Deer Hunter, but that doesn't look like the movie that I'm thinking of. What's the one that she's sitting in the rocking chair with a rifle? It's black and white. You like it a lot.
Night of the Hunter.
That's it.
No, it's a totally different thing. Yeah,
yeah, no.
This is, 78 was a De Niro, Christopher Walken, John Cazale. Meryl Streep is in it as well. And it's about a bunch of friends a couple of buddies who wound up going to Vietnam, and things they have an adventure.
They go well.
I guess that's the only thing that I'll say about it.
Yeah.
They have an adventure. The Simpsons did an incredible, incredible riff on the Deer Hunter once when Mo went into his basement and asked a bunch of people to stop doing what they were doing as they all were playing Russian roulette. Anyways, The movie. We're not going... I don't know. How far into the weeds do we want to get into this? Oh, my goodness.
I don't know. It was
Let's you do the overalls, right? Melissa, I think the movie actually starts really well.
Like it's like Courtney said, it starts with really creepy music. That was literally the first thing I wrote down was creepy. Also, I watched this while I was in the midst of watching The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix, so I was unable to sleep for a very long time.
You got scared from this movie?
This was really creepy, yes, and it had very, they weren't Hill House vibes, but they were at the same time. And I don't know. It, yeah.
I mean, there is a Hill House connection. I can get that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, legitimately, there is a Hill House. Yeah. They shot on the same mansion. Yeah, I like the way it starts off. I think it's I think the whole film is actually really well shot.
Yeah, also
I think that's its highlight, is the cinematography in the film. But I don't know. I don't know how much. Okay, so you found it creepy, you found it scary. Courtney, did you find it at the same level?
Absolutely not. I was not scared by this movie at all.
Just in the beginning, because it was creepy.
The opening was creepy. I think the opening was definitely the creepiest part. But as soon as it got into, like, people talking and being annoying, I was like, oh, I'm not scared anymore.
So, yeah, that would be the Achilles heel for this movie is I don't think the acting is very good outside of Bette Davis, but she's not really given that much to do. Ryan, did you have an issue connecting with that? Because, all right, so most of the film is driven by three of the younger kids, Jan Curtis, Ellie Curtis, and then Mike, who's like, Mike Fleming is the, I guess, semi-boyfriend or like boyfriend in mold for Jan. That's like they're building a relationship. But the three of them are extremely monotone and very shouty.
Jan in particular.
Yeah.
Jan in particular.
And Ellie is so screechy. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, Ellie's very screechy too.
Yeah.
So Ryan, did that have a speed bump for you as well, or what?
It did and it didn't. So I've seen this a number of times over the years. I don't know why I torture myself every time I do it to myself. But I was rewatching this again and trying to get more out of it. And I noticed myself when like Bette Davis wasn't on, I was drifting away from it and into whatever else I could occupy my mind with. And then coming back in, going, oh right, yeah, okay, this is an important scene. Like trying to, you know, snap myself back to it. So it didn't have that feel. It almost had like just, you know, a background noise feel to a good large chunks of this to me.
It just feels like, and I don't know if this, I know the ending had a lot of mismatch with it, but I feel like the beginning had a lot of mismatch because it's like, we get the introduction of like, okay, this family is buying this house. And then like, Bette Davis character, Miss Elwood, like, is talking to the thing in the woods and like is like creepily interested in Jan. Like there's a bunch of like stuff going on, and like all of a sudden it like cuts to Jan talking with this guy like she's known him forever, and I'm like, didn't you just like move into this place? And it just felt very disjointed. Like I didn't know how much time was passing or what was like going on.
Well, and consider the endings we had originally, the first and in the intermediate ending didn't have Ellie tied to it at all. And for a good chunk of this movie, Ellie's the one wandering around, like the one who's, you know, speaking in voices. You know, she has the and then like in the original ending, they're like, yeah, we're going to forget all that and ignore it.
Yeah, and she's not part of that finale almost at all.
No. So at least in the rewrite, they got that right. They got the fact that they needed to include Ellie there.
Yeah, because, like, she was the one, like, almost like the conduit, but then, like, Jan's the one who looks like Karen and, like, the one that Miss Ayala Elwood was, like, more interested in, but I don't know. It was...
Yeah, because in the original endings, Ellie is only at the house, like, when they go back to the house, but in this one, she actually is in the church.
Yeah.
So at least brings her into it a little bit more. I remember thinking about, like, the very... loud shouting stuff, and for me, like, peaked when Jan went to Mr. Keller's house, because like the door opens and the dog's barking, and then Mr. Keller's yelling, and then Jan is yelling, and everyone's yelling. Just everyone's yelling. But it also brought up one of my favorite lines of the whole movie that has nothing to do with the movie. He just says, clear out of here, and all I heard was Jean Valjean telling Javert when he's gonna like not shoot him in the back, clear out of here. So I got distracted by that for a number of minutes before I could resettle myself. The scene in the mirror, Hall of Mirrors, I thought was pretty good. You know, I thought that was a pretty cool thing. That's the only part where I actually thought the camera work, though, was a little much. It was doing the zooming in and out very, very harshly. And for a majority of the film, the camera is pretty calm and creepy, but it goes a little into overdrive on that particular scene for me. I like the setup. That's the thing. Like, I like the setup here. But they don't do the haunted house bit.
Yeah, it like started to be set up like a haunted house, and I was like, oh, this is going to be really creepy. And then completely. It's like sci-fi.
Well, it doesn't even, I mean, do they even do the sci-fi until the very ending? I feel like that's the only time the sci-fi even comes in.
Well, the fact that she's like teleported to another dimension and she's speaking to people in the mirrors and like, it's a little blended there.
Yeah. Okay. But wait a minute. But you're referring to Karen, right?
Yeah.
But we don't learn that dimension thing until like the last sequence. Isn't that right? Or do we learn about that beforehand?
No, it's because it's either Ellie or which version you're watching, Ellie or the alien, tell you that.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So it's at the very end. So that's the thing. Like,
well, you knew something happened because when they showed the seance and they showed like whatever lightning or blue light strike the church before it went on fire, like you knew something happened there.
Absolutely. I didn't know if it was sci-fi. Like it still could have just been like haunted ghost stuff, you know? Mm. But then it winds up that, yeah, she was taken to a different portal and there was all this other stuff. But I think I liked the movie more when it was just trying to be about this missing girl and this seance. But then that was another thing that was a little confusing as a watcher. And I think we just said before, hey, they never explain what were they trying to achieve with that seance? Because I feel like that's important for us to understand, like, what these kids thought they were doing.
It was supposed to be some sort of initiation into their group, but that was never explained. It's just
is an initiation. Are you worthy of, you know, is she worthy of this group? But, like, what group? Like, just a group of friends? Because, man, what a tossing aside of coincidences that, like, you did this in a church above it. Like, is this something they've done before? How do you make a triangle with only two members if you have to add a third? I have so many questions.
And why was it Ring Around the Rosie? I've never seen Ring Around the Rosie, A, not move, and B, be like a seance type thing.
Is that explained in the book, Ryan?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and do some more digging. But I think this is where Disney got their wires crossed. You know, this is very much, I believe the book, from everything I've seen of it, was a science fiction novel. It was very much a science fiction novel. But then when you have Tom Leach, you know, pitching this to Ron Miller, it's like, this could be our Exorcist, which is an entirely different road for a movie.
Yeah.
And so I think they just continually kept crossing the wires the whole way through.
Yeah, like they couldn't figure out, like, do we want it to be a haunted house film? Do we want it to be sci-fi? Like, where's the... Because even if they kept the haunted house with a seance, like, that's still fine. That still works. But, like, then you bring in an alien. Like, it's just weird.
Yeah.
But again, they only bring in the alien at the 12th hour. So that's the really
weird
thing. But even then, I didn't understand it. Like, so the seance happens. There's an eclipse, which forces then this seance to send this girl through another portal, and then she's trapped in a triangle type thing in someone's spaceship?
Yeah, I don't know.
It needed the image of, I think in one of the alternative endings, that, you know, because she got trapped in that, whatever that glass engine thing is, they needed like her mirror image to get her out. So they needed Jan effectively to come get her out. But it's not like it's the same actress playing the same. Like, there are differences between these two girls. So
yeah, she actually,
really, you could have used any young person, technically, probably to get her out.
When she appeared, like when Karen appeared, I looked at the television and I was like, looks like Jan Brady.
Mm.
Looks like a grown-up version of the child. Of, like, she didn't actually grow up. She just became an adult but kept her face of Jan Brady. And that was all I could think of. But yeah, if you want to mix haunted house with sci-fi, that's fine, that's cool, have it make sense. And I didn't feel it made sense.
No, because I guess also with being Disney, like, they didn't necessarily want to have it like being a ghost, because then they wouldn't have wanted the girl to die. I don't know, but it made it so weird, because then it's like, but now you've kept her the same age and her mother's old, so like, that's going to be...
Let's talk about the old mom for a second. The old young mom for a second.
Old young mom?
Because this is really great. Because, no. So yeah. I'm, Bette Davis.
They tried to
de-age her.
Yeah.
To make her, when they did the flashback scenes, and they did the makeup tests, and you know, Bette Davis was in her 70s at this point. And I love John Hughes, who cleared the room after the screen test, and it was just the two of them, and he looked at her and he goes, "Betty, I don't think you've made it." And she took a long drag of her cigarette and said, "You're goddamn right." Yeah. And so they had to cast Georgina Hale as the young version of her. But I love that she was like, "Yeah, thank God you realized it."
Yeah, this is funny because like we see this now in so many. When that scene happened, I was like, "Oh, in a modern day thing, they would have actually been able to do what they would want to probably do."
Yeah.
And then I read that, they tried to do that. It didn't work out in that sense.
Yeah.
The Karen backwards thing, the Narek thing, in an age post The Shining. Oh, wait a minute. Is this post The Shining? If this comes out in April of 1980, this is really close. I think The Shining is 1980.
The novel was published in 77.
When does The Shining film? I mean, granted, yes, it was in the book, but...
1980.
But yeah. When in 19... May. So The Shining comes out officially 2 months after the premiere, the New York run.
1 month.
Of A Watcher in the Woods, where the playing on, you know, saying a word backwards right. is really, really prominent. By the time The Watcher in the Woods actually comes out in 81, to a general audience who maybe doesn't know about the book The Shining, that must seem like the cheapest ripoff of the thing that they just saw that was really popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, and you play the same thing with the novel. Like, if this, you know, this book came out in 76... The Shining comes out in 77. You're still playing with that same vein. Like it was it in the original A Watcher in the Woods book, or was that, you know, or was it something they added into the movie?
Oh, are we gonna have to read this book?
Yeah.
I don't know what the word "we" means on this one.
It's the royal we.
I already have Artemis Fowl to read now because that trailer.
Artemis Fowl. I've never read those books either. I gotta maybe have to dig into those.
At least it's not until August.
So the story works. Eh. Wait a minute. Let me finish the rest of the sentence. The story works until we start getting answers, and then when we start getting answers, it actually clouds what seems like just a haunted house film.
Yeah.
But with that in mind, what were the parts of this that did work for you? What are the sections, Melissa? Well, not the sections so much, but like the pieces of the narrative or an actor or actress or something about the film. What were the things that did work for you?
Oi. I
don't think it's that bad that you got to say oi. You thought so?
No, because the thing is, it gets so disjointed. Like, I really was interested in this as a haunted / possession / whatever creepy, you know, movie it was initially going for. Like, oh, okay, this old lady thinks that this girl's like her daughter, and then there's this weird blue light in the woods, and maybe she's possessed in the house. And again, I was watching Hill House at the time, so I was like very in like that mindset.
Uh-huh.
Of like, you know, the house or something in the house is gonna be like the thing. And then like, yeah, once we got to the, I don't even know which point through it, because it started getting really disjointed with when they brought in Mike and like just like having.
You don't like Mike, huh?
I don't like Mike.
Jesus.
I don't know. It just started to get really disjointed, and then I just really slowly got out of it. I don't think there was one thing that like made me jump out of it. But
were you still into it when the motorbike sequence happened? When Ellie was like being channeled, you would have assumed, I guess, at that point that it was Karen speaking for her, but it was really an interdimensional bug.
Yeah, because sure. Like it was like a possession kind of still feel, so I still felt like that was cool.
What was that?
I don't know.
Guys, hold on.
What's something outside?
Yeah, I hear it. Yeah.
I don't know. There was a rattling sound, and then a couple of notes on the harmonica were just played right outside our door.
The hook brings Whoa. You back.
It's the ghost of John Popper. It's the future ghost of John Popper. Oh, so I'm sorry. What?
I don't know.
All right. So
when it was still like in that possession kind of mode, like, is this little girl possessed kind of thing, that still had me in it. I don't.
Okay.
I think it was when I don't know where it took me out, but it started getting weird.
From what you're saying, Courtney, it seems like it was the very ending that was the thing that throws Melissa off, maybe, because I feel like they stayed on that haunting thing until it just suddenly wasn't. How did you feel with that?
I mean, I generally felt that way, too. I was trying to figure out what was going on. I was like, okay, maybe Ellie is, like, possessed by something positive, and then there's something negative in the woods that's, like, maybe the house, it's, like, a positive haunting, and the woods is the negative haunting, and, like, maybe there's something interesting going on there. But, yeah, I mean, the end just totally loses you. And I also, I loved the... I loved when Bette Davis was like we thought she was drowning Jan. Yeah. I loved that. I was like, sweet. There's something like really sinister going on here. Bette Davis is actually crazy evil. And I was in for that. But then we find out, oh, she's like just saving her from a tree branch. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of just wish they would have gone down that route. Like, if you're going to make it that way, like Brian said, they wanted it to be their exorcist. So just make it that way. Just do it.
Yeah, like make the Watcher in the Woods like the actual like creepy thing. It maybe it did possess Ellie, or it's trying to hurt Jan, or something's going on. Like, you know, and I don't know. Make Bette Davis the hero then. I don't know. The Ring Around the Rosie ceremony thing is just still such a weird thing. And then for everyone to be like, we're not talking about it, like they were
well,
like
the girl disappeared.
No, I know, but I mean, like they made it sound like they were doing some kind of like weird ceremony. So like, yeah, it would have been cool if they were like, oh, we got it out of this book, or I don't know, some type of actual.
So if they just didn't call it Ring Around the Rosie, you would have been okay with it?
Well, like, give me, like, it wasn't like, oh, we played with the Ouija board and things went wrong, like that, you know, we could all understand like where that happens. Like, it was just a weird, like, we don't know what happened and why it's so secretive. Like,
Ryan, are you in this? Are you in the boat here as well, where we don't get a fair enough sort of amount of information to even understand motive?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a lot of, you get more questions the longer it goes on, less answers. You know, the visuals don't make sense, from a blue cloud to all of a sudden this bug creature. Or even the yellow pillar of light that shows up at the end. Like, there's a miscommunication amongst effects. And they did. They had the, you know, the answers are, if you didn't want to hit the book verbatim, they have answers in the book. You know, they're the character, I went back and looked, they're the character who keeps talking about how they think that there are dryads in the woods. So there's, you know, these kind of mischievous spirits, nature spirits that are in the woods. Great. There's your Watcher.
Yeah.
That's your other side to it. You know, Ellie in the book still writes in reverse, so that does happen. So going back to that, does happen in the book. So there's answers there if you don't want to take it straight up the sci-fi angle to make it more of a ghost story. And I think that's where this movie succeeds, is when it's a ghost story, mm-hmm. is when you have this, you know, yeah, you're trying to figure out what the communication is, which communications are good, which communications are, you know, malicious. And, you know, you had the broken glass, you have the mirrors breaking, you can't see yourself in the mirror, but you can see yourself in a reflection in a pond. Like, great, let's play with those, with that, and make it a true ghost story.
I just think they missed an opportunity to use Bette Davis in this movie, mm-hmm. because it's very clear, based on the caliber of the other actors in the movie, that, I mean, it's always clear, but it's very clear because of the caliber of the actors, that Bette Davis has a serious command of the screen. Like, when she's there, it's so powerful. So they really could have just taken a spin on the book and made her the murderous mother. And the house is haunted by the daughter that she killed. I mean, it's really there. When you watch the movie and she's on the screen with her Bette Davis eyes and that presence, it's built in. They could have just done it.
Yeah.
It just seems like such a missed opportunity for them to go off and do some weird alien crap.
First mother in a Disney film that lives, it turns out.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been great if she was then the murderer at the end of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there seems to be more of an opportunity to really capitalize on the tone and the feel that they introduced from the very first couple of minutes of the film. that then I won't say spiral, like, because it doesn't. That's the crazy part, is that it doesn't spiral out of control.
No.
It just sort of at the very, very end throws you into another film.
Yeah.
Without much prep for it. And as they do a number of times, you know, they do hammer across the point that the person speaking through Ellie is not Karen. But it's just such a left turn when, oh, it's an interdimensional being that she got sucked into this thing and was trapped in this cell. It's like, that's so much information to get in 3 minutes and then just have the movie close, because they don't linger. You know, the Karen disappears up, you know, during the ceremony. I'm sorry, not Karen. Jan disappears during the ceremony again when they reenact it. And then she kind of just pops back in, has the girl with her, and then Bette Davis walks in and, like, that's it. Finish a film. So.
Well, and I think even to that point, weird. We talked about this earlier. The name The Watcher, I think, is only mentioned once, and it's in the original and alternative ending. And it's, like, the last line of the movie.
Yeah.
I don't think in the version that's out, like, the public version, I don't think the name The Watcher is ever mentioned. It's, like, there's just this glowing light, and it's this being.
Yeah, so there's no differentiation of, like, I just assumed the Watcher was Karen.
I don't know, but they set it up in the beginning because it's so creepy, and, like, Bette Davis even, like, turns to the woods and's like, they're here, is that what you want? Like, she's talking to something, and it's like, what is it? Like, how does Bette Davis know this interdimensional being?
Yeah, and then, like, she never really communicates with it again, and there's no verification if she was just, like, crazy ass talk. Like, did she understand what happened? Did she think she was just talking to her daughter the whole time? Like, either one of those is acceptable in this scenario. It's fine. But if you don't do anything about it and you don't have that character, I don't know, pull Jan aside and really try to, like, help her. Because she tries to mine the kids for information and then their mother gets pissed off at her.
Yeah.
But we don't get her giving any information. Like, she could have worked a little bit as, you know, like, Basil Exposition to a very, you know, smaller extent.
The bad thing is she didn't know. Like, to her daughter just disappeared one night. So, like, she couldn't have really, I don't think, given much information. Like, beyond, like, my daughter disappeared and now there's this thing in the woods. Like,
that's a lot of information, though. There's this thing in the woods and I can communicate with it. It talks back to me, like, that
but
information.
Does it?
But I don't know, because she never says. That's the thing. Like, that information could be very helpful, at least towards getting us on a road where we're like, okay, well, maybe there's something different. Maybe she's misunderstanding, you know, at least something. But I don't think that we get the correct information.
We don't.
No. From a studio that usually gives you an overabundance of information and simplifies that plot so much, this seems to throw so much on the grill at, again, the absolute last minute. That I think it harms the final product of what could have been a really good, creepy, which is partially, actually, I'll say it, which is partially a very good, creepy film.
Yeah.
It just loses me towards the end. So do you want to, let's get into our questions. What are our questions, Melissa?
All right, we're going to see if the film still holds up. We're going to pick the iconic shot of the film. And we're going to see if there was a moral or an emotional pull to the film and if it succeeded at doing either.
Okay, so let's start from the top of that tree branch, which would be, I don't know, which one do you think? Moral?
Yeah, I guess.
Courtney?
I don't think this is necessarily a moral film. I don't really get that from this at all. And in a way, I don't really get too much emotion from it either. However, I think that was the goal. So I don't think it succeeds, but I think, you know, the story with the missing daughter... you know, we have Bette Davis, who's obviously very, like, you know, we feel bad for her. Her daughter's gone. And they do kind of hammer that home with the music box and, you know, her daughter's name shows up and, you know, all this stuff. So I think that's the goal, but I don't think it was achieved at all.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. It definitely fell a little flat in that.
Ryan, if it even had a moral that it was going for, because I agree with Courtney and Melissa that I don't think it succeeded at that. But do you think that it had a moral that it was aiming at, or was it just trying to tell a nice, you know, sci-fi haunted house story?
I think it's just it was trying to tell a nice sci-fi haunted house kind of a thing. you know, the only moral you could, if you nitpicked into it, you could, you know, like, don't haze your friends in the woods in, you know, a creepy church. Like, that's about as far as you could take that, take a moral stream. But yeah, no, it was, I think it was trying to be emotional. I think it is effective when played through Bette Davis. I think for the rest of the movie, it doesn't play.
You know, it's even crazier, like, in this whole thing of it, if you look at the characters from the beginning of the film to the end of the film, they don't really change much.
No.
Like, Jan is pretty willing to look into and understand, like, what this thing is from the very start.
Mm-hmm.
We even have, what was her name? Mary Fleming. The mm-hmm. woman, the girl who was in the triangle initially,
mm-hmm.
She almost like runs away again. Like, she learns nothing.
Yeah.
From the first experience. No one really has an arc. Everyone is just sort of the same person they were at the beginning of the film. Just Bette Davis gets her daughter back.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to go on. Iconic shot. I'll start off with this one. I actually think it's right at the beginning. It's seeing her in the mirror. With that triangle light. Like, that's the thing that I think of when I think of this film. It was out of the Hall of Mirrors, but I'm going to go with the mirror shot of the girl looking, you know, with the blindfold. That shot right there of Karen, the first time we see Karen, not knowing what her name is. That would be mine. Melissa?
It's either that or when Jan's initially looking out the window and sees, like, the little light in the woods and then the window breaks. Like,
okay, but that's a sequence. What's the shot? Because her looking out the window, then seeing the blue light, and then the window crashing are three.
Yeah, that whole thing.
That whole thing. Okay.
It's a composite shot.
Courtney, how about you?
I'm going to go with the Karen in the dust on the window when the music's all like, blah. That's it.
Actually, I really thought that the actor, Francis Kuka, I thought that was a really good reactionary shot. Like, the fast zoom into that, like, wow, yeah. And her freaking out. I was like, you know what? That was a good creepy little thing, but it is very shining at that moment.
Yeah.
It's extremely shining at that moment. Ryan, how about you?
It's the one image that always sticks with me is Bette Davis in the woods with the giant tree branch when she's just trying to drown Jan. Like, that's the image that always sticks with me.
All right, that works. So, you know what? I think there's got to be something to a movie that at least had a number of images that stuck in our head. I think that's a thing. But does it hold up, Courtney Van Rens?
I'm going to go with no, just because I think the ending, I just don't want to watch this again. I wasn't a huge fan of The Black Hole, but I'd rather watch The Black Hole and this if you put them next to each other.
Well, the ending at least definitely gives you something.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to think about, even though it's still a very strange ending. You at least have something kind of like to think about instead of just being like, that just literally didn't make sense. I can't make sense of it at all. So I'm going to go with no. I probably won't watch this one again or recommend it.
Melissa?
Yeah, I think the ending made so many more questions and barely gave me any answers that made me want to watch it again. Like, I did enjoy the build up to it, but then with what we got at the end, I'm just like, nah. There's other movies or things that did this well better. So
I'm in the same boat, unfortunately. You know what's crazy? If you gave me the balls crazy ending of them like flying through space and seeing the spaceship and then going in the spaceship and her releasing Karen from that thing as they like hold hands, as little as that even explains anything that really makes sense to me, at least it's so odd that I would sit someone down and I'd be like, you got to watch this, because there's no one who would, if you show them the first hour and 10 minutes of this movie, would write down insectoid type alien grabs Karen, they fly through space to a spaceship, and I mean, grabs Jan, and then Karen is locked in a spaceship, and that's how they save her. Like, no one's writing that down. So when that ending happens, it would be something to just watch someone go, what the what was that? And that almost might be worth it. But as it is, the ending is just sort of confusing. It's confusing, and it's not very satisfying for what I was hoping to be, or what I remembered in my head as more of a haunted house thing. Like, I watched this movie as a kid, and this ending did not ring familiar to me at all. But either does the space alien thing, so I definitely didn't see that version. But it just doesn't carry for me, which is a shame, because, again, I really enjoyed the first half of this film. I liked where it was setting up. Yes, the acting is too shouty and stuff like that. It's not great. But I liked the feel of the film, the tone of the film. But it just really lost me at the end. Ryan, how about you? Does this film hold up?
No. But I am happy that it's moved the black hole up Courtney's list a little bit. I'll take that as a win. You know, it's interesting, though. Like, there's enough in here. For one, this movie's only 68 minutes, I think. It's a very short movie. So there's room to flesh. There was room to flesh this out and give this a little bit more meat on the bones. But it makes me interested in maybe reading the book, or even though it's Lifetime and Melissa Joan Hart directed, it had Angelica Houston in it.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see what the remake looks like. Like, what, you know, is that a better version of this?
Which ending did they go with?
Right. Which ending did they go with? Did they go back to the book, or did they go, you know, lobster with seaweed? There's interesting pieces at the beginning of this that hold my interest, but overall it doesn't hold up.
To all that I have read about the remake, it is actually far worse than the original, yeah.
Right, but it may be that far worse that's so bad you're like, you need to see this.
Okay, all right. Yeah. It might
one
be
of
worse.
Us will eventually stumble onto it and we'll report back.
Yeah.
I feel like that's likely to be me. I'm probably going to search this one out.
The Houston.
I feel like it's likely to be Courtney and my wife making me watch it in my house is what I actually
with a drinking fun. Game.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Well, you can buy it for $5 on Amazon streaming. Just so
I'm not
you
sure
know.
It's worth that, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's there and it's on Vudu. This is the new version again. You can own it for $4 on Vudu. So there you go.
And I have my movies anywhere to Amazon anyway, so it'll throw it over.
There you go.
That's some poster art. That's really good. What was that?
One of the actors.
Tallulah?
Yeah, Tallulah.
Tallulah Evans?
Tallulah.
She has no
by
face
the way,
on Vudu.
A positive they made from the book, I guess because I've been reading some of the stuff in the book as we've been going through all this. In the book, Jan is 15 and her pseudo-boyfriend Mike is 19.
Ooh.
So, right. So at least they've made them more age-appropriate in the Disney version.
Jesus Christ. Okay. All right, guys. Well, hey, that's our – what's up, Melissa?
I have a review to read.
Oh, read a review.
Yeah, it's our first one in a little bit, so that's nice. It comes in from Bobo the Clown, one of my favorite podcasts. my love for Disney has increased tenfold after listening to the DMH folks for about a year now. I get so excited every time a new episode drops. I love how they review movies as they come out, as well as the catalog classics, and I love their casual chemistry while also staying on topic and educational. Keep up the fantastic work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I think that's it for this week now, though, yeah?
Yeah.
Melissa, you got to go, actually. You got to get going. You got to go. You got a date with Morimoto.
I do. And 12 beers.
All right. She's driving, so I don't know when the hell you're coming home.
Midnight.
Yeah, I don't know. You got to actually really consider, like...
Oh, I know. I was considering I'm going to be probably walking around Disney Springs for a few hours.
Okay, good. That or I'll be a widower. So... More to find out later on the Disney Magic Hour.
That took a turn.
Is that or I'll have
at the
you...
very end, it took a turn again. We've done.
Yeah, that's how this show's going to go now. For all I know, later on, Melissa's going to be taken by an alien into a spaceship through dimensions. You know, shit that happens when you go to Disney Springs. All right, guys, thank you so much. And gals, thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. We'll be back a couple of weeks to do a Nightmare Before Christmas. I believe, right? We're going to do that for our little holiday selection. Yeah. So looking forward to that. We'll see you all then. Until next week, say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Ryan.
Say goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Pete. See you later, folks. Don't do any ring around the rosy seances and have one of your friends sucked up into another dimension. Tip of the week.